Most of you probably recall that I've been giving a series of talks about Ezekiel. We worked our way through the early chapters because Ezekiel is divided into two approximately equal halves. The early chapters are very historical. They're very, they deal very specifically with what's going on in the land of Israel just before the Babylonian conquest. And then when we step into the second half, we begin to look at the nations round about, go from that to the sort of futuristic destruction of Tyre, and then from that into the talk that we gave last time dealing with the Valley of Dry Bones, which has, of course, in the short term, its implications for the return of the people to their land under the Persians, but it has a much longer-term outlook than that, as we pointed out last time. Then after the 37th chapter, which deals with the Valley of Dry Bones, you step into a period of turmoil, intense turmoil, which is focused on the land of Israel, and come out of that then with the promise of a future temple and a future distribution of the promised land, and let's use that phrase. So tonight we've got a very different title. But I want to fit it into that theme and that flow of ideas, because I want to raise a couple of questions for you. And the first and the overall question is this, that if the Bible starts out in Genesis with the formation of mankind, and then as soon as mankind has been formed, you get into a situation where God removes people from the tree of life. And then when you get to the very end of the Bible, you find a circumstance where there is a tree of life which is there for the healing of all nations. Now, in between is the Bible. And in between, then, is a sequential and a purposeful flow of ideas from the situation where people were prohibited from getting near the tree of life to a situation where the whole world is given that prerogative. How do things like Ezekiel fit in there? How does this purposeful destruction of the nation and all of the things that were written about the reasons for that destruction, and how then are matters like the Valley of Dry Bones and the temple which is promised, how do they mirror and how do they fit into that overall purposeful movement from Garden of Eden and the removal of people from the Garden of Eden to, as we said in the book of Revelation at the very end, this tree of life which is for the healing of all nations. Well, I decided to generate some of the ideas for this by looking back into Genesis. And the title this evening, I realize, is a word in there that Christadelphians don't like to use. It's the word church. And the title, indeed, was very common among Bible commentators in the Victorian era. A lot of very learned churchmen who wrote in the early 1800s used this phrase, the patriarchal church. And many of the ideas which I'm going to present to you now come from writings such as that. But you see, the word church conveys the notion of building, for one thing. And it conveys the notion of ritual and form and order and all of those other things which are different from the more flexible way that we handle our meetings. Our rigid way in which we don't have people who preach to us every week and so forth. The priests that we don't appoint. But rather, we all take our turn at these things. We have a different system, a different flexible system. So one of the questions you can ask then is, how do we fit with our attitude and our structure of our meetings into this moving purpose of God? So as I say, the concept of buildings and so on don't seem to fit with the sort of life that the patriarchs led. Because until we actually go back into the land of Israel, with Joshua, there, even at that point, They're still living in tents. They're still very nomadic. They're still very mobile. And certainly prior to the time when these people went down to Egypt, they were pastoralists, and they moved back and forth along the Euphrates Valley and finally settled within the land of Palestine, as we sometimes refer to it, land of Israel and the Palestinian state, that whole territory, as we know it today. So how does this thought of structure fit into a society like that? And how does this development give us a hint of where God's purpose is going and how we may, when we come back to look at Ezekiel, then develop the ideas which are finalized within the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy? Well, when we think about the situation with Jacob and the what's probably mentioned in the margins of your Bibles as Jacob's ladder, and the situation then that Jacob found himself in at Bethel, and what he did, the vow that he performed, and what he later accomplished when he went back there a year or two later, we begin to talk very seriously about structure and form and ritual. And those things are very definitely there. But before we get there, I want to look at the situation in the 19th chapter of Genesis and the situation that Abraham found himself in at the time when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. Genesis 19 and verse 27 reads this way: "And Abraham got up in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah and saw the smoke," and so forth. But the phrase that I want to interject into the thinking right now is the phrase that Abraham went and stood before the Lord. Now, that phrase is very interesting. The word "before" can be indicated, and it is throughout our Old Testament used in the same two ways that we use it in English. Jack spoke before I spoke. It's used in the sense of time. But that's a much less frequent use when it's in this meaning here. But when we speak of being before the Lord, we almost always mean being in front of a situation where there is something representative of God. In the last four books of of Moses, there's 35, if I've counted them correctly, instances where this phrase "before the Lord" is used. And on each of those occasions, it refers to the tabernacle. And it refers to people bringing their sacrifices or to the priest being there in some part of the tabernacle, but before, in front of God. And that, I think, is the phrase which we've got here for Abraham. That when Abraham was standing before the Lord, Abraham was standing in a place that he had set aside as a place of worship. So that if we back up now into the 18th chapter, 22nd verse, we meet the same phrase. "And the men turned their faces from thence," and these visitors that had come, and we know that they were angels, came to Abraham with news of what was happening here and relating to Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth. "And the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before the Lord." Now, where was Abraham? First verse of this 18th chapter. "And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre. And he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked. And these men came to him, and these were the men that brought the message to Abraham of what was happening in this part of the world at that time. They also brought the message which was very important to Sarah at that time, saying she should have a son. So, before the Lord, I suggest to you that it is indeed referring to a place which was set aside. Now, when Abraham got to the plain of Mamre, he had earlier built an altar. And there was then a tent which he had erected in this location. And that was the place where he was, and that was the place where he could look down and see Sodom. Now, the idea of a tent is interesting, because when we come later to the interval when Moses has received the Ten Commandments, we read that he passed through the people, and everybody watched him go. And he went to a tent which was set outside the camp of Israel. And there, in the Jewish translations, it's usually referred to as a tent of meeting. In the translation that I have, which is the 1611, it's referred to as a tabernacle. It was a tent of the congregation, the tabernacle of the congregation, as it is referred to in the translation that I have. And as we said, the Jews referred to this as a tent of meeting. It was a place where it was set aside for people to go and meet God. It was a place, a structured place for worship. And that, I think, is the notion that we have here. It was prior to the idea of the tabernacle, and yet there was a tent there which was set aside, which would be recognized as a place where people went, somewhere that people went. The tent of the congregation, as it is called in my translation, that's in Exodus 33 and verse 7. Now, Torah also makes a very clear distinction between the idea of the tabernacle and the idea of a tent. There was, of course, a tent in the tabernacle. And it was at the far end, you enter the tabernacle from the west end, and from the east end, and progress toward the west. And at the west end, then, there was the holy place, and the tent was over that holy place. And so this tent of meeting, as it had been in the time of Abraham, was then transported and placed inside the enclosure of the tabernacle. And the altar, which Abraham had constructed and presumably was there in front of this tent, was now encompassed within the courtyard of the tabernacle. Isaac erected an altar at Beersheba, and Jacob erected an altar at Bethel. There was very definitely specific places that people went to for the purpose of worship. It's interesting when we go back even further and we think of what happened with Cain and Abel. There's a word there. It's the word brought. And it says that Abel brought, and it also says that Cain brought. And if you think about that word, it means that there was somewhere where they went. And when they were there, it was obvious that they had brought things with them. And so the suggestion is, and I think it a very good one, that there was a place set aside, a specific place set aside for the worship of God, even that early in the development of the Bible. When we look at what happened to Cain, he was driven out from before the presence of the Lord, and so that area was then forbidden to him, I would suggest to you. And what does it mean then when speaking about Cain, when it says sin lieth at the door? Which door? Which door? Was it the entrance to the place where people went specifically as a place of worship? So we may not have a building, we may not have a church per se, but we do very definitely have the beginnings of a structured form of worship. Places that people recognized, things that people realized were specifically devoted to God and matters that belong specifically to God. Now, I'd like now to go to the chapter that we read, Exodus chapter 18. First verse is very interesting because it speaks of Jethro as being the priest of Midian. And also, back in Genesis, we're not going to talk about it anymore this evening, Melchizedek was, of course, priest of the Most High God. And he ministered to Abraham, and tithes were given from Abraham to Melchizedek. So already we have things going on that we normally associate with the law of Moses, and they were going on long before Moses was established. But to go specifically to Jethro, in the first verse, Jethro was the priest of Midian. He was Moses' father-in-law, and he was interested in hearing all that had been done in Egypt. And, of course, as we read, Moses related these things to Jethro. So, I want now to go a little further down towards the end. It came to pass 13 in the morning that Moses sat to judge the people. That's an interesting phrase. It indicates that there was some basis for this judgment. It indicates to us that there were things which could be recognized and things which could be determined according to some set of standards, doesn't it? And what were those standards? And Moses' father-in-law saw that everything that he had done, he said, "Why do you do this by yourself?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire. When they have a matter, they come, and I judge between one another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and the laws." And this is before the things that we come to think of as the law of Moses. This is before we think of having a written and a documented and a well laid out sequence of legal precepts as we think of them very often in the writings of Moses and the later writings of Moses. So there were obviously standards. There were obviously precepts. There were obviously recognizable regulations and laws which Moses could use in his judgment. Where had they come from? And what was there? Also, on this matter of priests, two more little points just before we leave Exodus, just very quickly. Exodus 24 and 5. And Moses took half of, and he sent young men, I'm sorry, I was reading the sixth verse, the fifth verse, and he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. Moses took half the blood and so forth, sprinkled it on the altar, and the book of the covenant. We're now into the point where the law of Moses is being formulated. But before Aaron had been consecrated, there were young men who were recognized as having the ability to perform the rites of the burnt offering. Exodus 19, one more point. Exodus 19, verse 22. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and charge the people, lest they break into the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And let the priests also, which come near to the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them." And this was when Moses was going into the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments and the statutes and the regulations that we know of as the law of Moses. And before that happened, and before Aaron was consecrated, there was this group who were known as the priests of the Lord. They were recognized as priests. Who were they? Who were they? And how were they recognized? I'd like to start and pick this idea up from the story which revolves around Jacob and Esau. If you'll come with me now to Genesis 27 and look at what transpires here regarding Jacob and Esau. And the question that we've raised when we're getting to this is, who were these priests and where did they come from? If they were there later than Aaron, we would know. They would be part of the greater family which issued from Aaron. But long before that, we have the mention of priests. So why are we here in Genesis 27, looking at the situation where Rebecca is manipulating things so that her younger son could take over the birthright from the elder son? Rebecca took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her youngest son. And then transpired the business of going in to see Isaac. And Isaac sort of challenging, said, "You sound like Jacob, but you don't seem to be Jacob. You feel different," and so forth. And Jacob went close to his father in verse 27, kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord had blessed." What do you mean by that? What did he mean by that? What was the smell of the field? Well, Esau was in the field. That's where he had gone. But he wasn't wearing that particular garment. And Esau was in the field hunting. And the garments that Esau were wearing when he was out hunting would probably have smelt of dust, maybe of animals and blood and things like that, if he had had a successful hunt, maybe of sweat and things like that. But that was not what was intended here, was it? For this garment had been kept at home. This was a particularly special garment, and yet it smelled of things that belonged in the field. And the suggestion which comes to us from men who studied this matter long ago, and I'm indebted to Blunt particularly, who wrote this little book, Undesigned Scriptural Coincidences, for this point, his suggestion is that here we were looking at something which was worn when the eldest son officiated in front of the altar. That this was a garment which would have been associated with priestly functions. That's why it was kept in the main tent at home. That's why it was only used on certain occasions. And that's why it smelt of herbs and things of that nature. Because even before Moses, and this is an interesting little phrase, the phrase in my translation is with the art of the apothecary, when we get later on into Exodus and read of the way that the anointing oil and the incense was prepared, and when we also think of things like the use of hyssop and so forth in various actions within the law of Moses, there were a lot of herbs there. A lot of things which would, particularly when burnt as incense, have left an aroma on a garment like that. It wasn't a hunting garment. It wasn't a working garment. It wasn't something which got this outdoor smell from being taken out when you were working. It was something that had picked up that smell because it was used in a very specific fashion. It's not the only place where we get this idea in Genesis. But the rabbis developed the notion that it was the eldest son in this period who was given the role of priestly function in the family grouping. It was the eldest son who led the worship. And they developed the idea from two points of view. Firstly, in my translation, the phrase is goodly raiment. I don't know what you have in your translation, but there are various other ideas around this. Pleasant is one of the ideas which you can get for surrounding that, and various other words which it was obviously a garment of some sort. If you trace those two words through the Old Testament, the word garment, the word raiment, which is here, and the word which is translated goodly, the word goodly is used for a number of very specific and very desirable things. And it's used particularly of things which were desirable from a point of view of the religion which was practiced by the Jewish people. We read, for instance, that the pleasant things of the temple were taken by Nebuchadnezzar, and that's in Ezekiel. And that's the same word. It's certainly used of things which belong in the temple. And there are two words particularly that are used for clothing in the Old Testament. One of them is here, and the other one is used just for anything that anybody wore. This garment, not exclusively used for the offices of the priests, but often used for things which had a specific function. This word is used, for instance, for the widow's garments. So if you wore something to denote that you were a widow, this word gave that idea. It's used for kingly garments. And it's certainly used all the time for the priestly garments as you work your way through the Old Testament. But it is not exclusively used for that purpose. So this idea is not bulletproof, shall we say. But nonetheless, the word which is here indicates that the coat was used for something important. And that's carried in all of the uses which we have for this word throughout the Old Testament. What about the coat of many colors, which Joseph wore? If you look in your margins and in some of the more modern translations, it's indicated to us that here we're talking not so much about many colors, but about many pieces. Why emphasize a number of pieces? Why emphasize this point? And probably because the pieces were different. Probably because the pieces and the difference in those pieces had some significance. Now, if our earlier idea, which we presented to you from the situation of Jacob and Esau, and as the rabbis earlier developed it, and starting way back in the Middle Ages, is correct, that the eldest son was given this role of leading the family in worship, that job would have been Reuben's. And Reuben would have been the automatic leader of the family, if the rabbis are correct in this judgment. And Reuben then would have worn the priestly garment. But we know that Reuben, shall we simply say that he misbehaved himself with Bilhah. And then, interestingly, there are just two little words in the translation that I have. It says that Jacob heard of it. There's nothing said about it other than that. But Jacob knew what Reuben had done. So, this is a situation then where, because the younger sons and the younger wife was the favorite, where Jacob would probably have preferred to see his son Joseph carrying that coat of many colors, that priestly garment, and leading the family in the family worship. There were three colors in the Aaronic priesthood. There's purple and blue and scarlet. And so it's not at all unreasonable, and many have reasoned this, that it was indeed a coat with several colors, with at least three colors. That those three colors may very well have been the colors which were the colors from the from Aaron's priestly garments, and that the significance then of the coat which Joseph wore was that he was the one who was given the task of performing the burnt offerings and the other items which belonged within the family system of worship. There's an interesting phrase. When Abraham led Isaac up the mountain, Isaac carried the wood on his shoulder. And the two of them got to the top of the mountain, and of course Isaac had asked, well, where's the sacrifice? And the answer was that God would provide a lamb. And then we get a very interesting occurrence. Abraham built a structure, and it says he took the wood and he placed the wood in order. Interestingly, we meet that phrase again. And we meet it when the ritual is laid out in Mosaic law for the burnt offering, that the wood is taken and laid on the altar in order. We don't know what that order was. We don't know. Nowadays, if you want to know how to lay a campfire, you can find out from all sorts of sources. There are all sorts of little booklets and websites and things like that, which will teach you the most efficient way to lay a fire and to have it start and have it burn. We don't have any of that. So quite evidently, what's going on here is a knowledge, a sort of knowledge which is passed on through time, which the ancients did not think it necessary to lay out in great detail the way we might describe the laying of a campfire nowadays, but which was known, which had been there in the time of Abraham, and which was carried on in Mosaic law when Aaron and his sons prepared the altar for the burnt offering every day. The wood was laid in order. So we're starting to develop the notion now that there were definite places for people to go to worship, and these were set aside and they were recognized. That there were priests. We suggested to you that maybe back in the time of the patriarchs, this was the eldest son, and given you two examples of that. We've indicated that it's more than likely that there was a recognizable item of clothing which was worn for that purpose, which was kept aside, which had this special and this important function in the family behavior. And now we come to the things that were done and done routinely. And one of the first ones that I mentioned to you, that I suggest to you, is that what we have here is a very orderly way of setting up the altar, setting up the wood, and laying out the sacrifice. That it was known, it had been known for long before the time of Aaron, and it had been kept alive within this family. We mentioned very briefly a little while back that when Jacob was wrestled with the angel in the situation, which, as we said, is often referred to as the story of Jacob's ladder. And in the day when he woke up in the morning, he set aside a stone and he anointed it. He put oil on it. 7th chapter of Numbers, we start out in the first verse by pointing out that when the tabernacle was erected, it was all anointed. The whole thing was anointed. All the items which were there were all anointed with oil. But this, as we say, this anointing, which was important in the tabernacle, was also important when particularly when Jacob set aside his altar at Bethel. And also, it is mentioned in a number of other places. We won't look at them, but let's look at 18th verse. I'm sorry, my voice has started to give me trouble. 18th verse of Genesis 28. Jacob rose up early in the morning, took the stone that he had put for a pillow, set it up for a pillar, and poured oil on the top of it. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, "If God be with me, I will keep in this way that I go, and give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I may come again to my father's house in peace. Then shall the Lord be my God, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be in God's house, and of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." So we have several things which are coming here. Vows which are associated with the priesthood, tithes which were associated with the establishment of the priesthood, and your idea of a structure and a set place. And this, said Jacob, shall be God's house. An open-air house, probably with a tent accompanying it, but nonetheless a place which was set aside. And when Jacob returned And the story there is in the 35th chapter of Genesis. Genesis 35, verse 1, and God said to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there. Make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fledst from the face of Esau, thy brother." And in the 15th verse, it's emphasized again. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake unto him, Bethel. He talked to him of a pillar of stone, poured a drink offering on it in the 14th verse, and poured oil thereon. He anointed it and put a drink offering on it. So, you see, we're getting the idea that many of the things which we associate specifically with Moses were in existence in the time of the patriarchs. So the idea which is coming is that there were new things, certainly in the law of Moses, and we'll point out one or two of them shortly, but what we're actually doing is building upon a framework which was well known and well established, building upon a way of life, building on a whole set of ideas and principles and standards which had been part of the life of that family for a rather long time. Now, many of the beliefs, many of the things which were set aside and which we think of as particularly Mosaic in their origins were there from many years previously. Noah was instructed to take both clean and unclean animals into the ark. Well, the actual definition of clean and unclean comes much later, and it comes to us in Moses. But it's nonetheless recognized what was clean and what was not clean in the time of Noah. And the clean animals were used for sacrifices, and that's when we turn over from the 7th chapter into the 8th chapter, 20th verse, if you want to glance at it. When you turn over into the 9th chapter and the 4th verse, we have the whole notion of this matter of bleeding blood, bleeding the animal before it is used. The life of the animal was in the blood, as Moses said much later, and therefore that was to be preserved for God, and the animal could then be consumed for human food after it had been bled. And the idea of murder, thou shalt do no murder, which we associate with starting in the Ten Commandments, is there in Genesis chapter 9 in the 6th verse. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. So the thought which is coming to us is that because of the way Genesis tells us that God formed man, that should govern much of what transpires later. Adultery, you remember Pharaoh and Abimelech, Pharaoh and Sarah and Abimelech. Reuben, we've mentioned Reuben already, and the way he set himself aside from his father. Joseph and the women that were chasing Joseph in Egypt, this whole question of adultery is forbidden. Oaths were binding. You remember the situation where Isaac and Abimelech dealt with one another. Abimelech came back to Isaac, and he said, let us make an oath between one another, a sort of peace treaty, we might say nowadays, because Abimelech realized that there was something particularly special about the relationship that Isaac had with his God. An oath betwixt us exists, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee. And oaths, again, are something which we associate with Moses. And vows, Genesis 28. This is the time when Jacob is setting up the pillar, and we've already read this verse to you, the last verse of Genesis 28, the last four verses of Genesis 28, where Jacob vowed a vow unto God that that area should be set aside as a place for worship continually. Two more points, and then we'll wind up. And the one is relative to Sabbath. Prior to the giving of the law, when the Israelites were still in the wilderness journeying towards Sinai, they were provided with manna. On the sixth day they were to collect twice as much as normal, because on the seventh day it was the Sabbath. And what this then indicates to us is that the Sabbath was in existence, even though it had not been formally proclaimed within the law of Moses. It was still there and still recognized. Why should this be so, if it dates way back? Now, you remember that Joseph mourned his father 7 days. Why 7 days? Probably that time, mourning time period ended on a Sabbath, and from then on then the time was devoted to God. But 7 days, that interval, was there for Jacob, for Joseph to mourn the death of his father Jacob. And Jacob, when he was married to Leah, Laban said to him, well, take the rest of the week off, kind of thing we might say nowadays, because he had just been married. But again, it was a 7 day period. Why a 7 day period? And Noah sent out the dove 3 times, 7 days apart. So obviously this interval is coming to us right from the very beginning of time in Genesis. But the thing that I don't see in Genesis relative to the development of the law of Moses, much of what we have then was simply enunciated and laid out in considerable detail by Moses following the Ten Commandments. Much of it was simply laid out in detail. But as we've indicated, many of those things were already known. They were already part of life. They were not written down, and they were written down because it now was becoming a more complex society. There were more people, they were living in different circumstances, and it was necessary to have these laws in a written form. But the thing that I haven't seen any evidence of in Genesis are what we might nowadays think of as harvest festivals, the Feast of Ingathering and so on. Why should that be so? Well, because up until that time, they were a pastoral society, and certainly there was a time period in the year when the young animals would be born. But this whole idea of gathering sheaves and so forth really belonged with a more settled and an agrarian society. So that Jewish society was changing, and there were things which were built into the law of Moses after the patriarchal period which reflected the change in society. The other thing that I can't find in Genesis is the Day of Atonement. Surely there was a need for something like that in the patriarchal interval. But probably it was more of a routine and a continuous thing. As they moved, they realized that they needed the continuing hand of God in their movements to preserve their flocks, keep them from wild animals and so forth. And so probably they thought, more as we do nowadays, that this is not something which should be handled on an annual basis, but this is something which you need on more of a daily basis. And I think that's the idea which is developed when Paul says that if Paul wrote Hebrews, when it is said that we could write a lot about Melchizedek. The other thing which was definitely added, and which was very much a part of the law of Moses, and which was not there in the patriarchal period, is the Passover. And that's an obvious addition, because that referred to a means of deliverance, a specific means of deliverance, and a reminder of a circumstance that people had been in, and that they were now put into a different circumstance by the grace of God. So, questions then that I want to leave with you before I sit down are these. If the purpose of God is moving progressively, and if, as we have said, that much of the law of Moses was actually in force during the patriarchal period, was understood, the patterns, the behavioral standards, the fact that there was necessary to set aside a time and a place for worship, and it was necessary to do it in an orderly fashion. All of those things which were formulated in great detail in Moses are actually fleshed out between the patriarchal interval and the time of Moses. But then there are things added which reflect the progression of God's purpose. And one of those is Passover. And another one, of course, is the reflection of the Day of Atonement. So now when we come to look at something like the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, what should we expect to see if we take this point of view? That God's purpose is being developed. That part of the things that we have as time goes on is a new way of doing things because society changes. And Brother Jack talked about that a little bit, talking about Romans. And Hebrews certainly raises that point, for animal sacrifices are no longer part. We present our bodies as a living sacrifice nowadays. That much has changed. So when we look forward to the time when Ezekiel's temple is here, when we look forward to the repetitioning of the land and the reallocation of that land, what do we expect to see if we approach it from that point of view?